Hey folks, this is Jessie.
Hi, this is Helen.
And we're Asian bitches down under, and guess what? We're right in front of each other.
Yeah, recording. Very rare. Yeah, okay, great. Yeah. So we don't have video recording this week because for some reasons we had technical difficulties yesterday.
Well, it was my fault.
That's all right.
Where I live. Internet dropout.
Yeah, so...
Where I live in the city compared to Helen.
I know, Sydney City. If you think about
it. Unreliable.
The internet speed for Australia, it's always not the best in the world.
Yeah, right. I actually don't know about what it's like in the other developed countries.
Well, anyway, so it just happens that I'm in Sydney since last night. So I crashed in into Jessie's place with my young daughter. We went to an event, which is very nice. I might talk about it a bit later in our later episodes.
Yeah.
But today, what would you like to start with, Jess?
I want to talk about, I went to Melbourne this week. I think I'll kick off with that for the Being Seen conference. So ACME, if you guys don't know, is the, it used to be called the Australian, I actually don't know what it stands for. God, that's so bad. But basically, if you're in Australia, you probably know ACME in Melbourne, the Centre for Cultural Arts Museum, something like that. But it's like the media place, you know, and they have exhibits about, they have exhibitions about film and television.
Nice.
Screen stuff, basically. And obviously, this was the big... big opening exhibition tie-in that was opened by Gina Davis. So it was a collaboration between the American Embassy here in Australia with the Gina Davis Institute for Gender on Media, which, you know, I'm sure we've all talked about enough on this podcast. And so this day was, I was lucky enough to fly to Melbourne to cover the event. And it was basically a day of panel discussions, ranging from, sessions titled Seeing Ourselves on Screen, which featured Indian Australian actor, including Parvi Shraddha, who is the key role, main lead of The 12. Remember The 12?
I remember
that absolutely beautiful Indian Australian. She was there.
Yeah.
Fucking stunner. Nice. She's so incredible. And Elaine Crombie, who's an actor, Indigenous actor, Dr. Julie Peters, who's a trans actor, and then that session talked about what it means to be someone of colour on the screen and how hard it is, and then there was Gina Davis, who gave a long, half an hour speech about stuff she talks about in her memoir, Dying of Politeness, which came out, I think, last year. Okay. Didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't
Did
know that.
Did you know that? Yeah,
memoir.
No, yeah. Okay. And then there was a panel called Aging on Screen, which featured Sigrid Thornton, who we all know. Rachel Griffith was also there, but she wasn't on the panel. She was there to give an introduction to the day. And then another session called Bodies on Screen, which had disabled people talking about, the gross lack of representation on the screen. They talked about latecomers, you know, the SCBS.
Yes, I love that.
It's
so good.
Mostly what I wanted to say as a wrap up was I was happy that I was there. I was privileged to hear so many amazing people, but I swear by the end of it, I was really, really exhausted, in the way that often every time I go to events about feminists or anything to do with kind of like fighting for representation, it's just like really, really physically exhausting, because often with these platforms, what happens on these days is I'm all for women getting together and talking about the reality of how hard it is to be taken seriously as an artist, but me, myself, as someone who's there to hear them, I won't deny the fact that it's extremely exhausting.
Yes.
Because often what happens is they talk about how their own private traumas or griefs, or like the way in which, you know, they were jilted, or the insults that they are thrown, you know, like just hearing 4 or 5 hours of people's personal trauma.
Mm-hmm.
It's really tiring. It's very tiring. Yeah. It's very tiring. I just wanted to tell listeners, I'm not dissing the event at all. I think it's great that ACME have done this, and I think we can only benefit from more of these, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, as a personal person who goes there as a member of the public to listen to that, I just felt, next time if I was going to attend these events, I would be more careful with, like, maybe just maybe picking one or two instead of going to every single one of them. I did it because I was privileged enough to be able to cover it for my job,
mm-hmm.
you know, at Women's Agenda, so I'm glad I could do that. B, I'm genuinely interested in this because I, you know, I'm a film buff. I love film, and film is my first love, and, you know, of course I'm going to be interested in what it means for women to make films,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it was just like I guess I'm just saying it outside of my role as someone who was covering it, as a member of the public, I found it extremely, like, because also I'm a very empathetic person, and so, like, often when they people would on the stage talking about their private traumas, like, I got teary, of course, like, yes. It's just, like, awful, some of the stuff, like, Carly, you know, everyone knows the brilliant Carly Finlay, the writer, speaker, and appearance activist,
mm-hmm.
and she was talking about, like, often people, like, she would say she had moments in her life where kids would come up to her and just be like, "Oh, you're evil," or something, like, "You're the bad guy," because of her face, and in Disney films, all the bad villains are, like, facially disformed, mm-hmm. somehow, you know.
I think you made a good point about empathy when listening to these stories, but it depends on individuals as well, because I believe both of us are very empathetic.
We're too empathetic. Yeah, and I can't help it.
We're on the very extreme
spectrum
of feeling empathy. And I understand people sharing stories like that is to provoke people's empathy. That's a thing that we need. But should we move on to how should we pivot this kind of program into a more positive? I'm not saying that sharing stories are not positive, but...
Are you saying, like, what's next?
Yeah, what's next? Yeah. Because sharing stories is the beginning, but you create an atmosphere of full of negative energies. Because at the end of the day, it is really negative how you feel afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you think that they can pivot that kind of program into...
Well, how do we make change? Yeah.
Yeah, how do we make change, and instead of... continue to share stories, where to go from there?
Yeah,
because you do need to have a redirection to make it better.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Well, yeah, I think it's often like it's like the same kind of phenomena when you go, you know, the All About Women festival at the Opera mm-hmm. House. Yeah, like
it always feels the same.
Yeah, it's always the same. Always the same. Yeah. It's the people who are already converts, with feminists who go there and listen. Yes. Yeah. And I think it's a place of solidarity, I get it.
Uh-huh.
But the people who are going to actually make change are never there, you know. So the people who are...
Who have the power to make change. Yeah.
So the structural changes that are needed to make a difference in terms of representation and more women on screen, you know, key filmmakers and key funding bodies,
mm-hmm.
they were probably not there when they should be.
Yes.
Like the crowd, they were like... It was kind of like a mix, I have to say. There was a good, healthy crowd, I'd say 200 to 300 people there, mm-hmm. At the conference in Melbourne, mm-hmm. at ACME on Wednesday. I saw either older women or women over 50, mm-hmm. who were all really well dressed, and then there were, like, the other crowd was, like, young 20-21 year old, like, actors or, mm-hmm. like, up and coming actors.
Yes.
And I'd say in the crowd, I don't think I even saw one man in the crowd. Oh. I have to say, I saw, like, men. I saw, like, maybe one or two men around the hall, the cinema hall where it was held. But the only men I saw were like the tech guys at the back of the
sound staff.
Yeah. No, I did. I legit say I don't think I saw one single man at this event. I'm not saying there weren't any men. I just visually cast my eyes over. Didn't see a man. I also didn't see many Asians. Didn't see a lot of women of color. I have to say, mostly white women. Yeah.
Yeah, but you got to come back and think about it. This kind of event, how exposed is it to other cultures?
Yeah.
You know, like how diverse background cultures, institutions know about these events and can they afford it as well?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Because you were there for the work.
So they helped pay for me. But a ticket, charged. A full ticket for the whole day of five panels was $250.
Yeah, see?
Yeah, that's not like, cheap.
If you're in the acting industry, most actors struggle to survive.
Yeah, yeah.
How are they going to, you know, pay for these events?
Yeah,
you know, it comes back to kind of like a catch 22.
I remember, you know, I went to these events as a young person. I remember going to events very early in my life as like a 20-year-old.
Yeah.
And I remember being empowered by these events because it was like, oh, it was useful to know what other older women, like women who, you know, had years and decades of experiences, it was useful to listen to their experiences because then you can kind of adjust your expectations, right?
Yes.
As you go through life as a woman artist. But I think now as a 35-year-old, I'm kind of just like, nothing's changed. I'm exhausted. Like, you know, I'm like, it's 15 years now from when I first entered these spaces. And like, it's exhausting, you know?
Yeah, it's a very long time.
And also there's a really particular kind of grief I feel when you see someone like Gina Davis, who is white, able-bodied, absolutely beautiful, talk about the ways that she was marginalized. You know, it's like it's like the same feeling I had when I watched Britney Spears documentaries. It's like this woman has absolutely everything and yet still she's fucked over, you know, because she's a woman. Like there's a really private, really specific grief you feel when you hear those, because you're like, well, I'm Asian. Like, I have different types of...
We have less power.
Yeah, we're capital.
Power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, and this is me speaking as an able-bodied woman, you know? So,
that's right.
I think my favorite panel of the day was probably Bodies on Screen, which was the one with Carly Finlay, Taryn Brumfitt, who is the Australian of the Year this year, 2023, Milo Harthill, who's a 22-year-old actor, BLM host, queer and radical body acceptance advocate. Mm-hmm. She was the funniest, I'd say. Okay. I really like people who are just completely themselves on stage.
Nice.
And Amy Marks, who's a filmmaker and disability activist. They just spoke about the importance and the sort of how crazy it is that, you know, in Australia and also in America, one in four people are disabled, and yet we never see any.
Yeah, they're almost invisible.
Yeah, completely. And also on the screen, often people are just thin. You never see any fat bodies.
Yeah.
On the screen.
Yeah, you don't see average bodies.
Yeah, it's just
it's a place where they create a fantasy that not a lot of people can achieve. Yeah, I think that's what happens.
Yeah, and there's this one thing that Amy, which is one final thing before I wrap up this convo, and one thing that Amy Marks said that really changed my thoughts about, I guess, able-bodiedism. She said, like, kind of something towards the line of, like, we need to create more stories of disabled bodies because everybody will be disabled. You guys are just not disabled yet, kind of thing.
Yeah, and I was like,
oh yeah, that's right. Like, we're all gonna be somehow disabled one day, you know?
Somehow immobile.
Yeah, like it's the most kind of like universal experience because like you and I, we can't one day become black or we can't one day become queer. Maybe we will one day become queer, but like
if we come to our realization,
it's like we can't really change our sexuality, but like disability, like ableism, that will change. Yeah. That can affect anyone, you know. Mm-hmm. So that kind of what she said was like, oh yeah, like it made me just think.
Yeah, I think it will become more aware for people because with the aging population and the advance of technology that prolongs people's life but not prolong people's quality
of life necessarily. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, interesting. Yeah. Thank you for sharing.
And also, you know how I always say I don't like Melbourne? And I feel bad about that because this time I realised Melbourne has its perks.
Mm.
I guess that's a wrong word because Melbourne is not very perky. Melbourne is grungy like the palette is dark.
Yeah,
like, so I walked, I got there at like 7:30 in the morning. I took a 6 a.m. flight. Shout out to my amazing partner who drove me to the airport at 4 a.m. Yeah, and got there at 7. And then when I walked to Acme, it's in the middle of the city, near Flinders Station. It was like 8:30 in the morning. And there was this one moment where I was crossing a really big, large intersection. And there was like 500 people coming like across the street. And like all of them were wearing black.
Really?
Like Melbournians just love black. It's like I was like, and then when I walked through the laneways, like everything was kind of grungy and black, and I was like, Melbourne has a very dark palette, and it's just like maybe it's just like it feels like weather. Yeah, it feels like it's like a Melbourne is like an emo person. Oh, yeah, with a beanie.
Personality.
We like we like, you know, I remember I've said this on the pod before. Melbourne is like the, you know, the kid at school who like wears baggy pants and has long hair with a beanie and has headphones on
dark eyeliner
and likes the Velvet Underground, and Sydney is like the shallow perky blonde called Stacey, yes. Who gets her hair bleached in the summer and, you know, doesn't read.
Oh, it's so funny how you describe it. Yeah, anything else?
How was your week?
Okay, so this week, it's the final week of term one, so my kids have so many activities, end of the term performance, things like that. So I went to one of the concerts which my son was in, performing. I usually don't I don't find out the program until that I arrive at the concert, which is like 6:30 in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I found out that half of the concert is on Requiem. I can't remember.
Is that Mozart's Requiem?
No, it's not even Mozart's Requiem.
Whose Requiem?
I can't even remember the name.
Okay, yeah. It's like that's how interested Helen was.
It was like a contemporary composer. So 1900s. So it was... I don't know. Probably only Mozart's Requiem that I can sit through it.
That anyone knows, yeah.
Yeah, or anyone knows, but, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, Requiem is like a mass
at the funeral.
Music that you play at the funeral, yeah, for the prayers of the dead.
Yeah.
So it's not the best
cheery music.
Yeah, for high school students to play.
Jeez, it's depressing.
It went on for 40 minutes.
The whole Requiem.
Yeah, the whole Requiem, and they had... Latin choir piece in between as well, so it was
such
a negative energy coming out from it. I mean, the only place I want to listen to Requiem is at the church, and that's it.
Yeah
I mean, and we don't go to church at all. Maybe funerals in the very near future or something like that, but I just wonder why composers feel the need to write Requiem.
You know what, I have a theory.
Okay,
I think it's because like it's very solemn and serious, and it's the easiest way to be taken seriously, because it's like, I'm writing a piece about death. You know, I'm making a statement that's profound. There's so much profundity around humans, around death.
Is such a philosophical topic.
I think and you know, in the way that often when you're younger, I know myself when I was in my early 20s, I was obsessed with reading poetry about death, and I think it was something to do with like I think it's just a stage you go through in your life where you think death equals profundity, And when you're young, you want to find profound things, you know, kind of thing. Because profundity equals seriousness. And when you're young, all you want to do is be taken seriously. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Hi there. If you're new to our show, thanks for tuning in into our program, and we hope you will stay with us for a very long time. And if you are a regular listener, we're forever grateful for your continuous support throughout this period of uncertainty. It has really helped this podcast to gain a great exposure, as our mission is to center the perspectives of people who look like us, who are marginalized historically to the sideline of conversation. So if you haven't already, we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast on Omni, Apple, Google, or Spotify, and leave a rating and review. And of course, as a small podcast program, we rely on listeners' support to continue this work. Please do check out our Buy Me Coffee page and make a donation in order for us to continue to advocate the intersectionality in the podcast industry.
Well, anyway, yeah, that was my week. I don't even know if it's a highlight. Oh, actually, for highlight-wise, I'm probably going to share with my cultural consumption. Do you want to start first?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I have been taking a deep dive, as I've said, into David Fincher films. We did... So we've done Seven now, we've done Zodiac, we did Panic Room in the last 7 days, which is... we're saving... Fight Club for the end, I think, is his most famous
iconic picks.
Yeah. Panic Room, 2002, Jodie Foster, Kristen Stewart. It was great. It was fantastic. I don't know if I've mentioned, we also watched The Game starring Michael Douglas. It's a little known one. I think it's from 96 or 97. I don't remember. But it's very, very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's one that's forgotten. But apparently Fincher is not proud of it. You know, if you're a Fincher fan, I'd say give it a go. It's pretty good. Panic Room was fantastic. Forest Whitaker plays a good guy, bad guy kind of thing. A bad guy who's got the heart of gold, basically. I enjoyed it very much. Fincher, yeah. Also, you know, I'm going through 90s classics that I've shamefully haven't seen. Shawshank Redemption, haven't seen that, and saw it for the first time a few days ago.
Because when it first came out, it wasn't that appropriate for
your age. Apparently when it came out...
I watched it in school.
Did you? Oh, yeah. Okay. So it came out, this film, obviously, guys, came out in 1992, I think.
That's the year we arrived in Australia.
Oh, really? I might be wrong with that date, but anyway, obviously one of the most IMDb rates the best rated film in history.
Yes,
Shawshank Redemption. Really sad. It reminded me of Forrest Gump with the voiceover, with the decades. You know, decades.
The progress of the years.
Yeah. Morgan Freeman's voiceover. And the music is very, very Forrest Gump. It's like sweet,
era as well.
Sad. Yeah. Brilliant movie. It's like extremely, extremely poignant kind of film.
Yes.
Cried when Tim Robbins' character puts on opera through the loudspeakers in the prison. That was the biggest tear-jerking moment for me.
Mm-hmm.
Exquisite ending. Brilliant. Yeah. You know that Tom Cruise was also asked to try out the role for Tim Robbins? Really? Can you believe that?
No, I can't see Tom Cruise. In that role.
Yeah, he's too handsome.
No, I don't see him in that role at all, because he's pretty much typecasted into that kind of
Ethan Hunt
alpha male.
Yeah, he wouldn't have worked.
Yeah, he wouldn't have worked.
There were a lot of people who actually
audition for that.
Given the role. Harrison Ford was also turned it down.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh huh. Yeah, but I think Tim Robbins.
Yeah, Tim Robbins has it. Yeah,
he's got a good facial.
Yeah. You kind of think in the beginning, did he kill his wife? Maybe he did, and then
there's an ambiguous feeling
to him. His face. Yeah, exactly. He's very tall as well. Yeah. He's like over 6 foot tall.
Uh huh. Reminds me of another prison film.
Yeah. We love prison films. No, I don't actually.
Green something.
Green Mile. The Green Mile.
Yes, Green Mile.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Right.
That's like a problematic film.
That's a very problematic film.
I actually haven't seen it in a while.
Uh-huh.
But also another Stephen King book. So Shawshank Redemption was like a Stephen King short story that was adapted.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, Green Mile. Green everything. Green anything. The Green anything is problematic. The Green Book, problematic.
Yeah, that's true. It talks about so much like racial implications. Yeah.
What's another movie with the green? Isn't there the green? Isn't there a superhero movie called The Green Something?
Green Lantern.
Yeah, The Green Lantern with Ryan Reynolds or something, right? I don't know.
Bad reviews from that series, so I never really watched it.
Okay.
So even my husband, who's like a geeky buff, yeah, he said that he wouldn't even watch that Green Lantern.
And yours, cultural consumption.
Okay, so this week, I have a small background story to what I consumed this week. Over last weekend, I was listening to a Taiwanese podcast between an obstetrician who turned writer and her media friend. So they had this podcast called Wu Peining Liao, which she talks about female issues and from her perspectives as a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But then lately she starts sharing her personal stuff, because at the beginning of the year she went through her own divorce, so she talks about her feelings. She kind of opened up, which is very rare for her because she's a very introvert person. And then along that episode she says something reminded me of a song back in the 90s. She said 过去就让它过去的. Let the past
be gone. Stay in the past.
Yeah, stay in the past. Because people had asked her, because her divorce was a very peaceful divorce.
Okay.
There wasn't any affairs, there wasn't any arguments about finance. Uh-huh. They're all financially independent.
Uh-huh.
Her ex-husband was a doctor as well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So people had asked her, well, what happened to you? You know, what happened to you guys?
People want salacious stories.
People want something that's a reason. She just said that, we just fallen apart. We don't love each other anymore. But at times that she feel like, she feel like there's a little bit of regret in it. Like, should I have worked harder to maintain this relationship? But then during her conversation, she said that, just let the past be gone. And it reminded me of a song that which contained the lyrics of let the past be gone. And I looked up, I spent an hour, you know how you have that moment and times that you want to look for it, because you remember the rhythm of that piece of song, but you can't remember the title and the full story of the song.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I spent an hour Googling up, and then I found that Taiwanese singer who sang the song, which is called Tempting Heart. And the lyrics is very heartbreaking because it talks about breakup, let the past be gone. It's too late to like you from the beginning again.
Mm.
Yeah. Like, I will cry if the song start playing now.
Mm.
And I was just thinking, okay, I heard this song before and I can't remember where was it from.
Yeah.
And then I looked up again, see, my time was wasted. When you are so, like, you've been possessed because that you feel like, I have to look it up because it was in your memory.
Yeah.
And eventually it was a movie that is based on the same title, Tempting Heart, starring Takeshi Kaneshiro. Yeah, and it's a Hong Kong Japanese film, talks about depicting a love triangle from high school and all the way in their 40s. And it was such, and I looked up, and I said, okay, I'm going to spend next 2 hours in the evening when I had nothing to do to watch this film.
Mm-hmm.
It took me like 2 evenings because I couldn't go through the whole movie. I remember watching that film for the first time before I was 20. Like, mm-hmm. This is before I was 20. And now watching it again when I'm in my
40s. 40. Yeah, amazing.
It feels so different.
Well, how was it different?
Because for anyone who's interested, I highly recommend this film, Tempting Heart. The Chinese title is called Xin Dong. So starring Takeshi Kaneshiro and Gigi Lan and Monica Mok, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That sounds Hong Kong name.
Yeah, Hong Kong name. Yeah, she's a Hong Kong singer and actress. Because when I was younger, when I watched that film, I was so totally immersed in that love relationship when they were in high school.
Well, like, and love triangle. I'm guessing it's one girl and two guys.
No, two girls. The two girls were best friends.
And one guy.
And one guy.
Oh, I like that. I prefer that. Because I don't like those stories like two guys and a girl. It's like, ugh.
And you really can see that the struggles between two girls, that they want to maintain their own friendship over a guy who eventually the guy chooses
one of them.
Yeah. And the other one who wasn't chosen, you later found out she's actually bi, and she actually had a theme for her female friend as well.
Not surprised at all.
And when and later in life, that spoiler alert if anyone who hasn't seen it, but the triangle kind of continues into their later life. And when I was younger, I keep thinking, why do a certain person, when they become younger, do that when they're in their 40s? Like, oh, it's so bad what they're doing. It's they don't consider other people's feelings. But now, as a person who is in their 40s, and I feel like, oh, they have their own reason. Like, I feel more empathetic about the older character. Yeah, it's just such a good film. And the music is so good. I think that's the main thing, because of that song. It really breaks your heart, because someone eventually disappears in this world. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And where can we watch that movie?
I think, not the legal way, but... Oh, okay. Yeah, if anyone can find it, some people say that it is streaming on Disney Plus Asian regions, Tempting Heart. But okay. Yeah, I'll try to find. Like, they really have to show and stream these 90s Hong Kong movies on streaming platform, because it's so good.
1999.
Yeah, it's 1999. Yeah.
Best, one of the best film years ever. 1999.
Yeah, that's
Matrix.
It's so funny, because I've heard podcasters saying that all the good things happens in the 90s.
Yeah, but of course.
Well, the music and the film.
Yeah. Well, everything pre 9/11.
Yeah.
Life was different. That's why You've Got Mail is such a great film.
Mm.
Pre 9/11 New York.
Mm-hmm.
Fantasy. Ugh. Yeah. Just the best.
And so funny. There's a lot of nuance in that movie. Because it's all her, it's the female character's first love, and of course Takeshi, and you know that he was my huge idol when I was growing up as well.
Helen was obsessed with him.
And in the movie, that the subsequent partner she had also resembles her first love, like long hair, sharp jaw, it's the impact of the first person that you've fallen for. That kind of have influence of your later relationships. So that was...
Well, the very famous actors, Sylvia Chang, famous, Gigi Leung.
So Sylvia Chang is the director for this film. Yeah, and she made numerous films about females. And there is a film that I'm yet to watch. It's called 20, 30 and 40. So it depicts stories of... women in their 20s and their 30s and 40s.
I'd like to watch that.
Yeah, that would be a good film to watch.
Oh, yeah, here, from 2004.
Mm.
20, 30, 40.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we got to go on a Sylvia Chang filmography. We should.
Yeah.
Once a week.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Tempting Heart,
yeah.
The premise starts from Sylvia Chang as playing the older character of the young girl.
Oh, right.
Reminiscing about her love life and want to make it into a movie.
Yeah.
And she was having a conversation with this screenwriter.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of like having a back and forth about the story that she wants to create.
Yeah.
And the young screenwriter is kind of giving her questions like about the stories that she was presenting.
Yeah.
Like, oh, why was she like that? Why was he like that? Should we feel more empathetic about the guy's choice?
Yeah.
And it was such a good thing that it's almost like a therapy session. You talk about your past relationship.
Yeah.
And then people giving you a different perspective.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
So that happens in the film.
Right. Yeah. So it's pretty good.
Did your partner watch it with
you? No, my husband didn't watch it with me.
That's okay.
I think he watched it like we watched it a couple of times when I was younger, when we were younger, but I don't think that he remembers that much. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a very great film. Yeah, Tempting Heart.
Just one last thing before we wrap up these conversations. I like what you said about, you know, getting older and feeling less judgy about people. Mm-hmm. Or like just knowing that people have their reasons and yes. for that to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of letting people have their own private reasons and letting the fact that you might not know specifically be okay. Often because we don't know ourselves why we do that's the things right. we do, you know?
Yes.
The heart is a curious, mysterious thing. What's mm-hmm. the quote? Something like that. And it reminds me of, you know, it's kind of related to our conversation last week when I talked about Kate Legg's book, Infidelity and Other mm-hmm. Affairs. That's it, did I talk about that last
yes,
week?
Yes, podcast? Yes,
yeah. Right now, I feel like, I'm still like relatively young, not too young, but like I'm still kind of not, I haven't spent decades living to understand things like infidelity and why people do what they do, you know. I'm still right now in the mindset that I just can't believe anyone would cheat. Like, to me, that is like just so absolutely black and white wrong. That's my opinion. I just think lying is just like a really unjustifiable, morally bad thing, right? And lying to your most important person to
yeah,
you,
most
you know?
Intimate
yeah most person per- yeah exactly life. But I remember a few years ago I often talk about Barbara on this podcast, my, you know, a woman who in her 80s came into my life when I was in my early 20s and profoundly affected me and how I see the world. She spent a lot of years with her, mm-hmm. spent a lot of like would go on the weekends to have breakfast with her and her husband. Barbara was her name, and she and I, we used to go to movies together sometimes.
Oh, nice.
So we went to see a movie, I believe it's called Four, or something about Four Quartets or something, and it's a movie about starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, and where brilliant. He is in a quartet
uh-huh.
with his
what
wife.
What does he play?
He plays second violin, or he plays viola. I forget. I should look it up right now and tell you the name of it, because I would
love... I feel
love...
like he will be better playing viola.
Yeah, because viola players are, we all know they're...
Yeah, his appearance type. Fits more into viola.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just Googling. Oh, so it's called A Late Quartet,
mm-hmm.
And it's a film starring Catherine Keener as well, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Christopher Walken is in the film as well.
Okay.
It's directed by...
Names.
Yeah, it's directed by Yaron Zilberman.
Uh-huh.
Don't know
what year did the
so
movie
it came out in 2013.
Okay.
So I went to see this with Barbara at the cinemas,
uh-huh.
and so there's a plot line in the film where Philip Seymour Hoffman cheats on his wife, mm-hmm. Catherine Keener's character.
Yeah.
And in the end, they patch things up. She forgives mm-hmm. him. I distinctly remember me coming out and talking about the film with Barbara.
Yeah.
So I was like 25. Barbara was like 86,
wow.
I think.
Uh-huh.
And I was just full of anger. I was just like,
yeah.
Uh-huh. This is ridiculous. Why did she take him back? Like, why do people cheat? It's fucked up. And Barbara just like kind of was like just very kind of like, I think she, now that I look back, she had someone who had the face who wanted to say something to me, but just let me be. And she didn't say what she really wanted to say, but she had that air of like, people do things and like, it's not the end of the world. You know, kind of like, you haven't been in marriage for 50 years, Jess. You don't know what it's like.
Yeah.
You know, she was much more compassionate and kind of like non-judgy about the characters.
Yeah.
And like, it just like, it kind of made me just remind me that, you know, like when we're older, we will probably have conversations with our grandkids and laugh at them, thinking, you're so naive, you have no idea how easy it is to cheat on people or whatever, you know? It's like, yeah. And also Barbara told me, just on the topic of cheating, Barbara told me one of her friends when they were in their 60s, one of her good female friends, she was cheated on by her husband. And towards her end of her life, her husband actually said, I just want to let you know, I've been unfaithful to you.
She only found out towards the end.
Oh my goodness. And then the wife was actually really angry. She was like, why did you tell me? I don't want to know. You should have just kept it a secret.
Yes.
You should have just kept me out of, like, yeah, now my life is shittier because of this knowing.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So it just, you know, it just made me think about these things differently.
I feel like the husband did that because he wants
to unload. Closure. Yeah, he wants to exonerate himself, right?
He wants to feel better himself.
Yeah, exactly.
So
he's...
Yeah, I'll be angry with that as well.
So are you saying if your partner cheated, you would rather him not tell you?
No, I think not at my deathbed.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, I know.
It's like,
I know, how cruel. How cruel. Yeah.
We were going to talk about resilient. Do you want to go on to talk about resilient this week? Yeah. We were just on the subject of resilient last weekend. Like how different kids' resilience back in our days and the resilience now. Like what's resilient for us when we were younger?
Well, resilience is such a pop word these days.
Yeah, you know? I know. And on our phone conversation last week, after we recall, I told you that the resilient structure is so different compared to our own childhood now, because everyone's getting rewards. Like in primary school, everyone's getting participation awards. There's really no a definite competition between each other. I mean, there's still competition, obviously. And then I found such a big difference when my child came home one day and told me that they don't call it detention anymore. You know, when we were younger, call it detention, where they isolate a child somewhere else in the classroom or a principal.
For punishment.
For kind of like a reprimand.
Yeah,
punishment.
Reprimand,
yeah.
What do they call it now?
They call it reflection. You know, you can laugh loud.
Oh my god, I'm on the floor right now. Reflection.
Yeah, they call it reflection.
Sounds like some like segment of a yoga retreat. You know, 1 hour of reflection time, silence, meditation. They're gonna call it meditation in 10 years time.
I know, so my jaw dropped on the floor when she told me that. I'm like, okay, so what do they do in reflection? She goes, nothing. It's just the same. They just changed the name to not sound as bad, because detention is bad.
Yeah,
it's a bad word.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. What are they gonna call jail? Meditation. Solitary confinement. Solitary time.
I understand that they want to create a space that is
more positive.
More positive, exactly. Yeah, more positive for kids that they don't feel bad about themselves, because you do go into a cycle that, like, we all know that there's a statistic of criminals that the re-offend chances are higher if they're
going to jail.
Yeah, of course. If they haven't gone through, you know, some sort of mentoring or rehab.
Yes, rehabilitation.
Procedures. But I don't know if changing the name
actually does anything.
You're not really changing the structure of doing things
differently. Correct the behavior. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. And well, has your daughter ever gone into reflection?
Well, she hasn't, but she just she doesn't understand why, you know.
Did you ever have detention?
No.
Really? Yeah. I'm sure I swear I have, because I didn't do my homework or some shit like that. It is quite boring.
I was such a like an obedient Asian.
Yeah, of course you were.
Girl, when I was growing up.
Yeah, yeah.
That annoyed me a lot. And when I try to rebel, I feel like, okay, I'm just sharing a part of my own experience now. When I try to rebel, I feel like it crushes me so bad. And even thought that I didn't do things that was worse than any other, you know, naughty kids in school. Because I can vividly remember, this is when I was in year 11 or year 10. I was chewing gum in math class, and my white female teacher, who was like the head of math, you know how teachers have a certain image of Asian kids, and when you did some, I'm pretty sure all teachers are biased, you know, when
everyone's biased.
Yeah. And I think a lot of teachers are extremely biased, that they expect Asian kids
to be extremely good.
To, yes, yeah, well, yeah. I was just chewing gum. I think I was just trying to be a little bit rebellious. And then she was just so loud, she yelled at me and goes, "Oh, Helen, get up and go and, you know, spit your gum right now." And she made me, like, stood up in the middle of the class.
Yeah.
And I can so vividly remember, I just feel so ashamed.
Yeah.
Fucking chewing gums.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Yeah, I think we all have been violated somehow by a teacher. Not physically, emotionally, you know. Yeah, like high school is a very traumatic time for a lot of us. Yes, you know? It's a fucked up system.
Yeah,
if you're not like a fucking normie, like an extroverted normie, you find it hard.
Yeah,
I found it hard.
It was such a hard time to find a balance.
And I found it boring, actually. But go on.
I'm coming back to resilient. Some people, like older people, are saying that the kids are now less resilient. You know, the changing environments, that's definitely, that I can understand, you know. Yeah, it's so hard to find a balance to teach kids resilience now, I think.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I feel like there's so much buffering, you know, trying to cushion their falls.
Yeah, and there's a lot of clash of cultures too.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, a lot of schools are giving a lot of awards. You know, you get an award for participation. Is that even an award?
You get an award for breathing.
Yeah, you get an award for full attendance.
Yeah, well, we used to have that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, to show up.
Our brother got the best attendance award in primary school.
Because that's the reason that our mum forces us to go to school, which is why you were sick or not. Sick. Yeah, and I was just thinking, okay, so where does kids learn resilience now? Because,
well, what does being resilient mean in your definition?
I think it's the ability to stand up again when you have challenges. Yeah, the ability not to react badly. Yeah, and I think I want to talk about this because I'm experiencing through, you know, my youngest child who's 10 and she's processing through a lot of, you know, challenges
in her life. Hard to be 10.
Yeah, I know. I remember. You feel for her.
Yeah.
And then sometimes, you know, culture clashes, and my husband tend to be a bit more conservative person. He's like, oh, you have to be hard on kids so they learn, but you feel for the kids because you don't want to go through, like, the second time trauma for yourself as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And at the same time, I see a lot of particularly Asian parents telling me that, oh, why are they giving awards to every kid?
Yeah.
You know, Asian moms that I sometimes hang around with or hearing stories, they say that it's so strange that all the kids are getting awards. Then there's no point of giving out awards anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like if everyone gets an Oscar, an Oscar doesn't mean anything anymore. Yeah, exactly. And this conversation has been had for decades. It's nothing new, you know, we want to say. When I was studying education during my uni days, I remember one of our lecturers said the reason why America is such a, like, is so low in terms of, like, academic marks in compared to Scandinavian and Asian countries is because in America, every tiny little thing you do as a kid, the teacher commends you. Like, even if you get 50% of the class, you get commended. Whereas, like, in Korea, this is a white lecturer who said this. He was like, in Korea, if you you don't get praised for just getting 50, you know? Like, he said there's a culture of overpraising people and kind of, like, the bar in America for applauding someone or giving them credit, is way lower than it is in, like, Asian countries.
And I think there's this hierarchy of social differences of who is being praised as well, because there's a default image of I'm trying to explain it in the graphic sense that, you know how people expect Asian students, they always have to achieve 90%, and if they don't achieve 90%, they don't get praised, whereas perhaps there's a stereotypical image of maybe a white student, and if they can achieve 60%, they get a praise.
I know,
it sounds a bit racist here, but I feel like because Asian students in Western countries have already achieved, you know, academically above a lot of people, and they might feel like, well, if you don't get 90%, like, what are you? You know, that's a very discriminatory idea, obviously. But I feel like it does happen, and I don't know where to go from here, because kids nowadays...
Can I ask, why do you think resilience is so important? Why has it become such a buzzword?
I think it's mostly the challenges that we're getting is just going to get more and more. Not just environmentally, it's financial as well. And the world is, like, I want to see it from a positive point of view, but the world is not really getting better. Like, from my very pessimistic position. That's why I guess resilience is very important for kids, because you need to stand up. You can't just be hit by one challenge and never gets up. What about you?
I agree about resilience.
Mm-hmm.
I think your definition of resilience is spot on. I'd probably just say the same thing. Mm-hmm. Being able to stand up when you fall. When any kind of blows in life, you just get up, and the ability to pick yourself up.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the ability to know how to pick yourself up.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. Like, and knowing how to pick yourself up. What are the things in your life that make you happy, or like remind mm-hmm. you of your strength?
Yes.
And then being resourceful and like mm-hmm. knowing where to access those resources, you know?
Yeah.
That for me is being resilient. And I think it comes back to the relationship you have with yourself. And so, like, the self-talk, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like, I don't know how other people see me, but I feel like internally my relationship with myself, and this is, you know, thanks to 10 years of therapy, 10, mm-hmm. 15 years of therapy, I feel internally that I am quite resilient. And I think it has something to do with my, actually, it might not be a positive thing, but it might be something to do with my sense of self and how much I tie it in with achievements. So, like, I feel like when I get bogged down, I do tend to pick myself up rather quickly, only because, like, I feel like I need to prove to the world that I'm valuable in some way, mm-hmm. you know? There are different aspects of my life that are different, but I'm just specifically talking about my, like, writing mm-hmm. or, like, the work that I do that means stuff to me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Resilience, like... being able to kind of just like self-talk healthily. That's what I feel like resilience is. It's like the ability to talk to yourself in a very compassionate way
mm-hmm.
and to say like, it's okay that this has happened. Doesn't mean you're less of a person.
Mm-hmm.
And then say, okay, let's try again. Just every day, let's try again, you know?
Yeah. And also that you're talking on an individual point of view, I think the community is very important in the sense of resilience as well, because not many people, like what you said, have the resources to shift their mentality into that direction.
I am where I am because I had the financial means to mm-hmm. seek a therapist.
Yes.
I don't know where I would be without a therapist. Yes. Honestly, I hadn't had those 200 plus hours of talking out my fucking trauma mm-hmm. with someone, with a professional, I definitely would not be where I am today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think therapy is going to become like a necessity for a lot of people's life. It's almost like food and water.
Yeah, I really hope so. Maybe when I say therapy, like I'm. Just like the ability to have the a space where you can safely talk through.
Yes.
It's talking that really has really got changed things for me. Talking out your problems and your feelings over the period of years to a professional.
Yeah, so that's where I'm saying about the community. You have to have someone who actually absorbs and understands you and give you feedback.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just listen or sit there to listen.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that's so important. rather than, yeah, reflection and detention, you just sit there and you don't get anyone to talk to those kids.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, who did something maybe they didn't consider it was naughty. Yeah, so I wonder how that's going to change. I know schools have improved in the sense that they, you know, have counsellors throughout the years to assess kids.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That, but I don't know how much that they're doing for the social and economically more disadvantaged schools. Yeah, I feel like they're not doing enough. Yeah, so it needs to be have a structural change rather than just changing the word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember my teaching career started in 2010, 2009.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then like I remember the year when I started paying attention to the rhetoric around education and pedagogy, and it was like 2012. I was teaching at a private girls' school in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, and that was like kind of my first full-time gig, and that was when I had to start attending all the PD days, you know, professional development days. Yes. And that was when I first noticed the word resilience and the question that would be inevitably asked for the next decade every time we went into a PD development day session. The question was that was asked to us teachers was, how do we prepare our students for a world in which we don't know, you know, for the future?
The unknown.
Which I think is a kind of metaphorical way of saying, how do we teach a world with technology that we ourselves don't understand?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we know as, you know, well, our kids call us boomers, you know, your 17-year-old son called us boomers and we're like 40, we're 30s, 40-year-olds, yeah. But yeah, like kids, and you know, if you're a listener and you're not a teenager, you know that kids are way more tech savvy.
Yeah,
they're like they're technology natives, whereas we are not. You know, we're lucky we didn't grow up with technology, thank God. Yes. But yeah, I think this idea of like resilience and I think the word resilience and the kind of the pedagogical questions that teachers are asking, how do we teach our kids to be more resilient, is somehow tied in also to the conversation of like technology and how do we prepare our kids for a world in which we ourselves don't understand.
Yeah, we don't understand.
And we're not going to be in.
Yeah. It's almost like we need to relearn the resilient, relearn the resilient as an older adult as well.
Yeah.
Because we don't know. There will be a lot of things throughout technology advancements that we are not prepared for as well.
And I want to say, I get it. I guess I get the fear that adults would be staying up all night thinking about, because like a lot of problems that our kids, our younger students are experiencing are things we didn't
experience ourselves.
Like for example, porn.
Yes.
You know, porn. Yeah.
The accessibility,
online bullying, cyberbullying
of social media.
Yeah, all those things like our kids, younger people are experiencing. I get it. I get the anxiety of like not knowing how to keep our students and our kids safe when you yourself have no idea the sort of extremities of what they are bombarded with.
Yes. That's why a lot of schools are like introducing cyber like safety, you know, workshops. I know my kids, they had gone through 15 years ago was drug safety.
Yeah, and pregnancy.
Yeah, pregnancy. And now it's cyber safety. Yeah, because it's such an unknown territory for a lot of parents out there. And it's resilient wise, like how do you pick up, because we are seeing the harm that social media and the accessibility of internet done for kids. I mean, we need to see that, oh, it is helping kids, you know, social interactions and things like that, but what about the dark side of it? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, we're seeing the radical right wingers, they're recruiting, you know, people and young people online on Reddit and QAnon and whatever. And, you know, the rise of, you know, Trumpism isn't doing a very positive thing to the world as well. So, yeah, wow, that's such a big topic. I think we can extend that conversation to much further, but I think we'll Yeah, I think I'll only
I'd be curious to learn, hear from our listeners, you know, DM us, shoot us a message. Yes. Tell us what you think about this whole resilience debate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice to open up our minds, and we would like to know what you think of it. Yes. Okay, so that's the end of our episode. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Google and Apple, and give us a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support us, what we do here at Asian Bitches Down Under, head to Buy Me Coffee page and make a donation for us to continue the intersectionality in the podcast industry. So that's it from us this week in Jessie's Place, and we'll chat to you next time.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
We didn't mention Easter.